Hello and welcome to the Veeam Community Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Vanover. This is episode 49, Storage for Virtualization. Never too much attention. Here we go. Today, co-hosting with me again is Doug Carson. Welcome back, Doug. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Rick. Yourself?
Hey, I've been really busy. It's been Veeam speed all the way. And this is the first podcast that we're releasing in 2012. And I'm very happy to have on the podcast Mr. Jason Bakke. How are you, Jason?
Hey, I'm pretty good. I didn't know this was going to be the first one of 2012, but I'm honored to be one of your guests and one of the first ones in 2012. So hopefully this means good things to come.
That's right. Thank you. And, yeah, it's actually we're recording today on December 29th, but the logic is that I did take the week off between the holidays here, and I'm trying to get ready for the new year. Can you take a moment and give us a quick introduction to yourself, Jason?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm sure, you know, anyone who doesn't know me, which I'm sure there's plenty, will need the introduction. I'm Jason Bakke. I'm a blogger at bakke.net/blog. I've been blogging about VMware virtualization, a little bit about Hyper-V and Zen Server, some about Microsoft for a couple of years. And I'm also a I'm in technical marketing, virtualization product specialist at Dell Component in Prairie. I've been there for going on 8 months, I think. So I've worked the majority of my career and as an end user in mostly large enterprise environments, managing, you know, everything from Windows to Active Directory to, you know, in my later years, VMware virtualization, quite a bit of storage, and my move to Dell Component back in May of 2011. You know, kind of signifies my jump from that customer role to the vendor role, which I'm really liking a lot.
Yeah, that's kind of similar to me. You know, it's a big transition, but it's something that if you've got the passion for it, it's the natural transition. So I definitely understand that. So what we wanted to talk about today was storage for virtualization, and you know, there's really I can't think of any area of technology that requires as much planning when it comes to deployment, or maybe let me put it this way. I can't think of anything that can get you in as much trouble as quickly as the wrong storage solution. Doug, I don't know if you kind of feel the same way when it comes to deploying virtualization in general, right? I mean, I spend more time on storage than I do on the hypervisor. I spend more time on storage than I do the management stack. Processors are pretty easy. Networking and memory and all those other things. I just spend a lot of time on storage. How about you?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, when I first came into virtualization, I wasn't really a SAN person or a storage guy. And as soon as you start using virtualization, you kind of have to start learning pretty quickly how to size your storage. Because before I started doing virtualization, it was a case of, well, just give me so much terabytes in size, but mm-hmm. without really thinking about IOPS and stuff like that. But as soon as you start consolidating those workloads, then that's when you really start to have to think about IOPS and stuff. And yeah, definitely. I mean, it's something that is a building block, and you could soon get caught out if you don't architect it properly.
How about you, Jason? Does anything in your experience, you know, especially, I mean, now in your focus, it's definitely a planning point. But you know, historically, when you're an end user, does anything come close to the amount of planning that storage gets?
Well, it's kind of interesting how you open up this discussion. It's almost like you read my mind, you know, verbatim to how I would describe storage as one of, you know, the core foundational important pieces of, you know, consolidated, you know, virtual environments. It's certainly got a lot more complex and, you know, back in the days, you know, as a customer and a guy that had his hands on a number of storage arrays, it was really, you know, I won't say it was totally 100%, but it was mostly about managing to capacity and, you know, a little bit of performance. I mean, you know, we got bit a few times on not planning, you know, the right RAID levels or put, you know, splitting up host across, you know, the right RAID groups and so forth. But, you know, fast forward to this day and age, throw in virtualization in the mix, which, you know, brings with it just a whole behemoth of consolidation, you know, workload consolidation. And then, you know, now I add cloud and mobility and all that stuff, and it's definitely, we've come a long ways from managing to capacity, and even managing to performance is starting to go, you know, become just kind of a mainstream. Yeah, that's just what we do. Now we, you know, have to think about cloud and mobility and virtualized storage arrays and all that stuff. So really those things that we focused on years ago, all of those, you know, a lot like storage spindles itself has, you know, really become commoditized.
Mm-hmm. I think I spent a lot of time initially in my first passes of virtualization. I think I wasted an incredibly large amount of cycles, like, around memory provisioning, right? So I'm going to date myself in a 2006, 2007 range, where at the time, memory was quite expensive, okay? And to me, a LUN was a LUN, right? It didn't matter for what I was doing at the time, but, you know, you do a good job, and then you want to put everything in this VMware virtualization platform thing, and then from there, I don't even worry about memory. I don't even worry about processor types other than, you know, migration compatibility, but that's simple. So, you know, all those points you just identified, Jason, that's where I spend most of my, you know, a lot of my decision-making time. Doug, is similar story for you?
Yeah, definitely. But I think also as well, probably when people started using virtualization, they only did the test and dev environment, or they did the light, the, you know, the long hanging fruit, which maybe didn't push the storage to the kind of demands that we need. But now, you know, with, as Jason said, with all these workloads, with cloud and various other things now coming in, all these higher tiered multi-tenant scenarios are now, it's now making storage get pushed harder, and there has to be better integration with storage and offloads and stuff like that, which we're seeing. But definitely, it's certainly an interesting roadmap for storage and VMware and stuff like that, definitely.
Yeah, and Rick, you know, just to add to that, what I wanted to mention is, you know, again, the way that you approached, you know, the question or the discussion, it's one of the, you know, I feel the same as you. It's one of those, storage is one of those areas where there's, so, you know, first of all, there's so many vendors in the market in that storage space, and there is a tremendous amount of, you know, opportunity for, you know, today's storage vendors. And, you know, I even see new storage vendors coming onto the scene quite often. And so there's just so much choice and flexibility in what you can do with your storage. And then you hit the nail on the head. You know, you can certainly do things with all that flexibility. You have the opportunity to do things the right way to meet your business needs, to meet the business unit goals and SLAs. But at the same time, with all of that choice and variance comes the opportunity to do things the wrong way. And it's not that hard to do to, you know, get set in, you know, in the wrong direction, and you have a disaster on your hands.
And the risk that I see, and, you know, back to the earlier discussion of a terabyte's a terabyte, or, you know, a LUN's a LUN, and we need space, and we really don't care about the speeds and feeds associated with it, is then the other kind of hole that I think, and I've been guilty of this too, I'll admit it, is shopping by price, okay? So I'll take that terabyte, you know, usable space metric, and then take the amount of money that I could get out of this jam with the least amount of money, right? So then you run into the other problem where you can always buy lesser expensive storage. That's, I can never stop entertaining myself with how far down you can just keep going with storage, and again, that increases your propensity for some of these issues. But it's a real thing. And, you know, if you're getting started with virtualization and you haven't had this awakening yet, I think you will. But it's a big topic. We all need to be aware of it as virtualization people, and it's not going away. Anyone disagree with that?
No, I totally agree. And, you know, the cost of gigabyte, cost per gigabyte or cost per megabyte, cost per terabyte, whatever you want to look at, that's a, you know, that's an old-fashioned metric that we used to use, or at least I used to use as a storage customer. I still see it from used as a comparison tool. Mm-hmm. You know, even today, it's still, I won't say it's irrelevant, just to make sure that you include in that cost per gigabyte, you know, all of the management costs and overhead costs. To make sure that cost per gigabyte is valid, because now I see this in the hypervisor wars, where they, a lot of people and they focus on the sticker price of a product, which really doesn't paint the entire picture of, well, what's behind that sticker price. What kind of ease of management does it provide? What kind of automated tools does it provide, which is going to lower your total cost of ownership down the road? It's really not all about sticker price or cost per gigabyte if you're just going to include those fixed costs. You got to look at everything, especially nowadays. That's so important with virtualized arrays, because there's so much that goes into these things beyond just the ubiquitous nature of providing capacity on a spindle.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I find myself also, Jason, when you mentioned that, is looking at things like, well, what's the roadmaps with VMware, with Hyper-V and stuff like that? What's the integration points, and stuff like that? Looking at those kind of features as well. Because speaking to a colleague of mine who was doing a project, and the client he was doing the project for just looked at purely, as you said, the cost per gigabyte. But he was trying to convince him to say, well, look at all the things you've said, and also look at the roadmaps, look at how they integrate to VMware, what features they use and stuff like that, and trying to kind of get them to have a higher, kind of field of vision in a way about the storage that they're looking to buy.
I had a situation, Doug, along those lines that you reminded me when you brought this up. Basically, the situation was, The question came up, who is your consumer, okay, of the storage? And in my example, it was the growth area was clearly VMware, right? So when you make a decision on what product to align yourself with, look at who your biggest, consumer is, right? So if you're a VMware or Hyper-V is your largest growth area, which is very common for a lot of people right now, well, then source your storage products that put the most features in those pillars. It was kind of a simple solution when you looked at it that way. Yeah, sure, 2-3 generations of products ago, our biggest consumers were just physical Windows servers and maybe a LUN to the mainframe or something like that. And right now, those have become the anomaly. So think about it that way. So now I've got a question for Jason. So Jason, what's the biggest, and this is a kind of a trick question, but what's the biggest planning mistake you see related to storage as a general mistake? What kind of big issue do you see over and over again that people mistakenly provision or plan storage with?
Just a general lack of understanding of the requirement really to plan for first and foremost availability. I guess that kind of goes without saying. Storage is going to be useless if it's not available, and so that kind of speaks to, whether you need 5 nines, 4 nines, 3 nines, whatever, that's going to tie to your service level agreements or your business units or your customers if you're a service provider. But, the biggest, to get back to the question, I think the biggest thing is to make sure that you're sizing your storage requirements to, really down to the IOPS and the throughput that you need rather than the capacity thing. As someone that works now in the storage business, I talk to a lot of customers, I talk to a lot of prospects, and it's still pretty common to see people that are, they focus on capacity and really all the details in the IOPS, and the throughput. And, especially in a consolidated environment and with block storage and thinking about things like QDEPs and things like that. So, that's one of those things where, before you buy an array, you should be working with a storage architect, and you should really have all of that stuff laid out. And your spindle count should not be determined, at least not in whole, by the amount of capacity you need. And it gets to be quite a slippery slope.
Yep.
As the drive density sizes get larger and larger, people are naturally inclined to think, oh, I need less spindles.
Yep.
Because I've got higher density drives, even if they're 15,000 RPM drives, and God forbid they're SATA drives or 7200 RPM drives, that they're shipping in 2, 3, 4 terabyte form factors. So
right.
Bottom line is that even if you don't need you know, 100 spindles from a capacity perspective, you're going to need it from a performance perspective. And you've got to get all of those details laid out, because when you go live Monday morning, you know, there's not going to be a lot of room to be slapping in another 50 spindles because you calculated your storage performance needs incorrectly. And really all of that ties back to, you know, there's a lot of ownership. It's not just a storage architect or your vendor. You're going to have to come to the table with at least some level of detail about your environment and storage profiles, storage I/O requirements. And you can't just necessarily say, well, I've got 10 SQL servers and 20 Exchange servers and a VMware cluster with 100 VMs. That, you know, we can start to form an opinion on, you know, what that's going to look like, but there's way too much leeway in there.
Well, you bring up a good point when you say availability first. That's I was expecting the conversation about, you know, everything else, but wow, that kind of fundamental thought about the availability, and that's a whole nother onion, if you will, of layers of depth, right? And that's not just a RAID level decision, right? That's site, you know, continuous availability of your storage on multiple sites or multiple arrays. Wow, yeah, you know, again, you can just keep going with storage, and there's so much to it. I just hope everybody doesn't make the mistake of everything we're talking about, and I've done them. So we all learn, and that's the goal, is to share these learning points along the way.
Yeah, and there's not a whole lot to the availability discussion. I mean, really all that, you know, boils down to is, you know, a lot of redundancy, or, you know, a level of redundancy that's going to meet your availability requirements and get you that uptime calculation. So we're talking about, you know, dual head controllers, or, you know, redundant power supplies, you know, adequate number of spare disks, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's really, you know, there's a price tag associated with that availability, which gets exponentially and orders of magnitude higher as you get to that fifth nine. But on the grand scheme of things, or the grand scale of things, you know, a couple of extra spindles, a couple of extra power supplies, an extra head, you know, those levels of redundancy go a long ways to get you to, the availability that most organizations need, unless you truly need five nines.
The question that came up in my mind, Jason, when you were talking about that was, back in the day before things like auto tiering and stuff, we used to obviously say, well, we know that LUN is at certain RAID group, and we can get that amount of IOPS off of it and things like that. Do you think that in terms of trying to design your SAN, do you think things like auto tiering makes it easier, or do you think it makes it harder to design your SAN?
Well, the idea is, I guarantee you, the idea from every vendor is to make it easier on the customer, you know, who are the storage administrators, or, you know, service providers who in turn have customers of their own. So the auto tiering is designed to, you know, take out a lot of that legwork of, you know, getting buried in the weeds on setting up your RAID groups. If your array, you know, if you use RAID groups rather than large volume pools. You know, there's some storage vendors out there that have some pretty heavily virtualized arrays where, you know, when I talked earlier about, you know, spindle counts, if you've got a storage array that's able to wide stripe and provide automated tiering and automate, you know, a large number or larger number of RAID levels across spindles, you know, in a virtualized array, that's going to make things much easier. And it's also going to, you know, help minimize to a certain level, you know, that spindle count, because you're able to, you know, the fully virtualized array that does auto tiering, you're going to be able to put or place data on the spindles where it's needed in the proper RAID group, and you're not going to have to worry about, you know, having, you know, say 150 15,000 RPM drives just to meet RAID 1 capacity when only, you know, say 20% of that data on that RAID or on that tier 1 is active at any given time. If you listen to people in the storage industry, you'll commonly hear, you know, pretty much uniformly across the board that, you know, first and foremost, not all of the data that you put on any given, you know, tier one, tier two, tier two or tier three spindle, not all that data, you know, really belongs there. You know, if you guys have heard of that, you guys ever heard of the 80-20 rule? Is it applies to storage?
Yep.
So, you know, it goes something like only 20% of the data that's on any given type of spindle or flash drive is active or in use or relatively current. The other 80%, you know, once it's ingested and placed there, isn't touched again for a long, long time or ever. So why would you want to have that data on, you know, 15,000 RPM spindle, which is even your most expensive type of disk, you know, save SSD. So, you know, the auto-tiering, especially if you do it at the block level, the page level, is designed to, you know, move those blocks, put those bits and bytes of data on the tier of storage where it belongs and at the appropriate RAID level as well. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to save you a lot of money. It's going to save you a lot of time.
Absolutely. And that brings up a good question, Jason, because, and I'm kind of throwing you a trick question here, but as a general rule, if you had a choice, and I know there's no general rules in storage, so this is a trick question by two accounts, but do you prefer scaling out or scaling up on your storage? Because depending on how you go that way, you can address some of these issues or different approaches. Do you have a knee-jerk reaction yourself?
For me, if I was designing for a customer, for an environment, customer's environment, or for my environment, I would get the most that I can out of each and every array that I have. So scale up until you hit that IOPS threshold, you know, or the throughput threshold, and you know, as part of that, you have to determine, you know, the characteristics of what happens with a path failover, what happens with a head failure. You know, you want to make sure that you leave some headroom for things like that. If your, you know, number of paths or your SAN switches in the path, or if your head is going to be a point of contention if one of the, you know, redundant pairs fails. So, you know, my philosophy would be to, you know, for the money that you're spending on the array and to get the most that you can out of the licensing that you're paying for the spindle, scale up as far as you can, absolutely. You know, that's one of the, you know, the big benefits that many array vendors, or probably all array vendors, are going to proudly tout is, you know, how scalable they are. And, you know, when you talk about scale, that means scaling up first, and then when you, you know, if and when you need to, scale out.
So, Jason, I've always tried to change the application a lot, you know, to kind of dodge storage decisions, right? You know, I'll be honest with you, I don't always appeal to the idea of multi-terabyte VMs or just ginormous virtual machines or, dare I say, a monster VM. You know, what's your thought related to storage? Is it a good idea to change the app, you know, or do you just, you know, rock in the storage to meet its requirements? What do you think about that approach?
Yeah, I can't speak for every single, it's one of those depends questions.
Oh,
every single design out there, but I tell you what I value most, and I valued this when I was a customer of VMware and a customer of, you know, XYZ storage vendor, is having the flexibility of choice. So I'm not locked into a decision or constrained to a decision about scaling based on, you know, my hypervisor, my storage, or my application. I think that's, you know, the biggest benefit is that if everyone can meet in the middle and, you know, provide some options. I mean, no one likes, I'll speak for myself, I don't like ultimatums. And I don't like applications. I'm sure everybody's seen that application that they don't particularly like, that's old, you know, maybe isn't supported anymore, the vendor's not around, and, you know, that becomes, you know, really a pivot point for a lot of design and scaling choices going forward. So if I had the, you know, the ability for, you know, to make that app more flexible, you know, migrate it to a currently supported platform so that I had more flexibility and choice, that's what's appealing to me. And, you know, and the same can be said for my storage, for my network, for my hypervisor. You know, let me as a customer, you know, give me some choices. Don't just give me an ultimatum and say, well, this is the way it is, because this is the way it is. You know, that doesn't leave me, you know, in a very good spot. And I guarantee you, next time I have a bake-off, whether it's with my storage or my application or my hypervisor or my operating system, these are going to be the things that are fresh in my mind that, you know, I was constrained to a design decision to do one single thing, and that was my only choice. I probably partly dodged that question a little bit, but that's kind of how I feel. There is no one answer fits all for every, you know, application and storage and hypervisor, but I want the choice and flexibility.
Well, no, that's actually that's a great answer, because you're right. I'm asking you general questions, and that's actually a little bit unfair, because there are no general answers when it comes to storage. So,
I can give you an answer, you know, just a quick example, you know, in terms of hypervisor. I won't even pick on storage because, you know, I'm going to be positive aggressive here, but I have no problem with going after hypervisors. So, you know, a number of years ago, you know, if we compare VMware and Hyper-V from a features perspective, you know, with Hyper-V, we had transparent page sharing, which allowed us to do things like overcommitment on memory, get more return, you know, on our investment with our infrastructures. We can get a higher consolidation ratio by sharing some of our memory pages. Well, you go to the Hyper-V side of the fence, and, you know, a couple of years ago, even up to maybe a year ago, and then, you know, they had no concept of any kind of memory page sharing. In fact, back then they had a stance of, Microsoft had a stance of, well, you know, we don't agree with that. We think that's completely wrong. And, you know, if you need more memory, you should buy more physical memory. You know, we'll support it in our hypervisor. And I thought, well, that's not a very flexible design decision, you know, to have to just say, I'm going to have to buy more memory. And, you know, lo and behold, next release of Hyper-V, what did Microsoft do? They changed their stance. They now have a technology similar to page sharing, and that's kind of how it is today.
Well, and it's one of those things that the competitive market will adjust, and honestly, the two virtualization technologies, and Jason, I've got an interest in both, okay? But the thing is, they couldn't be more different, right? And sure, some of the fundamental things are kind of stepping in line to be comparable, but they're very different technologies, and I can find use cases for both, but I guess with all of us, our expertise is definitely more on the VMware side. But that's too passionate of a topic for this podcast. I'm not even going to go there. So that leads me to the next part of my podcast, and that is three views from you. So, Jason, I'm going to ask you three questions, one based in the past, one based in the present, and one looking towards the future. And these are questions to you as a technologist. There's no right and wrong, too short or too long answer. But basically, I'm looking for, stories or just personal opinions from Jason Bakke, the technologist. So let's start in the past. So, Jason, do you have any technical story, experience, or otherwise good event or occurrence related to technology from some time in your past that you could share with us?
Well, let's see. Past. I've always, you know, I'm known a little bit in the community from just on the basis of the lab that I have today, but no one knows what my lab looked like many, many years ago in the mid to late 90s. And that was probably, my lab back then was probably one of my, most prized accomplishments. You know, back then, the more physical things like, you know, more physical junk I could haul into my apartment, and then after that, my house at the time, you know, the more cool my lab was until, you know, eventually I started, you know, generating a lot of heat and, ran out of switch ports and all that stuff, and managing and juggling a lot of physical equipment, eventually became a hassle. But, you know, the lab, for me, since it, you know, it started in the mid 90s, is something, you know, that I use and lean on quite a bit, you know, for studying, for experimenting. You know, I spent a lot of time in there on certification. So, you know, for me, that, you know, that lab that I had back then, and, you know, and what it's evolved into today has, you know, for me, been one of my biggest, you know, I don't know, strengths
Oh yeah, and if you haven't checked
positive attributes, I mean that's just kind of how I learn. I don't go to a lot of instructor led classes. I'm more of a kind of a book learner, and I read a lot of big fat books. But I need a lab type environment where I can take what I've learned and get some positive reinforcement wrapped around that by actually performing it in some type of a lab environment. And that's what I do.
Well, yeah, you've got the coolest lab of all. And if you guys haven't checked out, go to Baki.net, and I'll put links in the podcast notes to his blog. But he has great videos and kind of some tells great stories. But I have a question about that, Jason. Has it been called Baki.mcse this whole time?
Yeah. Well, since probably about the year 2000, maybe. Back when buying domain names started to become relatively popular, and it also was not insanely expensive to acquire your own domain name. So it's, my roots are in, first and foremost, I started on DOS, and then, then shortly after that, Windows NT. So all of my, prior to my VMware life, I was Mr. MCSE, and, I was very heavily involved with Microsoft products as a certified systems engineer. So, the .mcse was the natural, kind of naming convention for my lab, and it was good as anything. Today I'm struggling. The past 6 months I wanted to drop that MCSE and change to something like, maybe VCDX, because, I don't dislike Microsoft stuff anymore. I'm just, I'm on kind of a different path right now. I've kind of been there, done that.
Yeah.
So now, I'm faced with the task and the difficulty of migrating, a 10-year-old domain, which has, Active Directory and Exchange and SQL and all these things in it, migrating to a new domain.
Well,
whether or not I want to go through that struggle.
Well, it's funny you say that, because when I remember Baki.mcse from all the screenshots, from your blog, but when I named mine, I just called it .intra, right? Because I wasn't really sure what I'd ever want to suffix it with.
I think I ended up mine with Contoso or something like that, because it was one of the example ones in the Microsoft book.
Well, going back to my roots, Active Directory Design, which is one of the core, you had to do one design exam for MCSE, and of course I chose designing an Active Directory domain. That was one of the most interesting yet philosophical experiences that I went through, because, like if someone comes up to you and says, how do you design a VMware environment? It's about the same as asking, well, how should I design my Active Directory environment? There's about 150,000 directions you can go,
sure.
And a lot of it boils down to the name and the hierarchy and all that stuff. So, I could have done intro, but I thought MCSE was cooler, but now look what I'm stuck with.
Well, and there's a certain amount of permanence to the Active Directory design that it's a lot easier to change up the VMware world than it is a domain. How about...
Yeah, and I'll throw Eric Spoof under the bus here, because at least my Baki.mcse domain is internal. Eric Spoof has the same type of experience with his external domain, so he's at ntpro.nl, which, he's been VMware virtualization for, probably as long as I have, so I get a little chuckle out of that and give him a little ribbon from time to time, and, he's got the same type of dilemma that I have in that, he's got this huge following on his blog, and he's also a rock star VMware instructor, and, this is probably a harder task than mine to change your external facing domain. I mean, that's a brand issue.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
So, but it's just a little funny story.
What's going on right now, Jason, in regards to technology? What do you have the most passion for today?
Well, today, of course, it's VMware. I eat, breathe, and sleep VMware virtualization. I have for the last, 3-4 years. And now, with my role at, in technical marketing at Dell Compellent, I've added storage to that, and, go back to our initial discussions about how key of a role storage plays in a virtual environment. By far, I think it's the biggest of the, maybe the most important of the four core research sources, with, you know, maybe networking being a distant second.
Yep.
You know, CPU and memory, you know, that's commodity, who cares? You know, maybe the CPU does FT or whatever, that's not, nothing's changing there. But storage is a biggie. So, you know, there, and by, you know, I wouldn't consider myself, you know, the most knowledgeable storage person out there. I'm trying to, you know, every day of my career, I'm trying to, you know, pick up more tips and best practices and design considerations for storage. And, you know, there's so much out there. And I talk to a lot of customers, you know, and prospects that have, you know, different types of storage arrays, and they kind of all do different things. And so, I have to keep a little bit of a handle on, you know, what the rest of the storage landscape looks like, not just Dell Compellent.
Mm-hmm. How about into the future, Jason? What are you looking forward to? You know, open-ended prediction. What are you looking forward to in the future coming down the way technology-wise?
Well, you know, it goes without saying cloud is going to be, you know, the headline for I don't know how many years, maybe permanently going forward. 2012 will probably be the year of VDI, fourth year running, I'm sure. you'd be amazed how many people, you know, they're enamored with VDI. They get VDI, they get the benefit. They just don't know, you know, quite how to do it. A lot of knowledgeable people don't know how to do it. You only get one shot at VDI, and you're only going to get, you know, the same can be said for cloud. If you're going to, you know, launch a private cloud, you know, or a public cloud, you're not, you know, reputation is going to be key. Just like, you know, going back to those earlier days when we're customers, Rick, when we're deploying virtualization for the first time on Monday morning, it better work.
Yep.
Because that impression is going to last a long time. So when we're looking at, you know, in the future, when we're looking at things, you know, doing things like cloud, doing things like VDI, if we're going to, you know, deploy new storage, you know, whatever it's going to be, it's, you know, for these consolidated workloads, it's important that we're successful.
Well, hey, guys, this has been an outstanding episode. Jason, we ran a little bit over, but I really appreciate the content that we've talked about. You're one of the best resources in the world. I'm so happy I had a chance to have you on. Doug, thanks again for co-hosting with me.
No problem at all. Thanks, Jason. Really enjoyed the chat.
Thanks, guys, for having me. It was a lot of fun. I would love to do one again. Can't find anyone else.
Oh, hey, no, it's not like that. I'll definitely have you on.
Yeah. Picture seat for next time.
All right, and you can follow Jason on Twitter at Jason Bakke, and his blog is www.bakke.net. Did I get that right?
You got it, Bakke.net. You can just go to the RIP domain, and I'll forward you to my blog.
Right on. All right. Well, hey, guys, thanks again for another great episode.
Thanks a lot, Rick.